We are four friends in three states across two time zones with a shared passion. Welcome to the Sports Talk Garage Podcast, where we hit the fast lane to discuss our favorite drives, from the track and the ice to the court and the ball fields. We are four lifelong friends who grew up with a love of professional and collegiate sports. Today, we are bankers, investors, professors, and entrepreneurs, but our love of sports has never changed. Come listen for the fun, gain some insight, and probably a few laughs as we give you our perspective on those last lap lead changes, game-winning scores, and franchise players. This is the Sports Talk Garage.
Hey, welcome back, Sports Talk Garage podcast listeners. This is your host, Matt. We actually have our full crew this week. John has come back from the dead, and David's with us. And we have a special guest, Tab Bamford, that we're very excited about. But let's go ahead and get an update real quick from David and John. How are we doing this week?
Well, North Carolina is a wonderful place to be right now. Trying to figure it out. I will be working from home for at least two more months, if not a little bit longer. So nice to actually have a decision made there on when I know I won't be back in the office.
Always nice.
There you go.
Yeah, same for me. I play a new job and remote work and all this fun stuff. So hanging in there, trying to stay motivated.
How often do you get to transfer jobs and end up getting to work from home at the same day?
Yeah, it's pretty rare. We're in unprecedented times right now.
Definitely. All right, without any further ado, I want to introduce Tab. Tab's a Chicagoan, so before the show, John and he had a good chance to catch up on some local sports. We probably should have just recorded it all and thrown it all on the show, but you know, for any of our Chicago listeners, we'd love to hear from you if you have any questions for him. But let's go ahead and get him on the show. Tab, thanks for jumping on with us. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, other than having not a whole lot to do and a ton of time to do the nothing with. you know, other than that, you know, it's a good time to catch up on reading, find some interesting books to take your mind off things, and wonder about how many times you can reschedule a fantasy baseball draft and how far you can really push it back to figure out if people are going to be healthy or not.
Well, the longer they're out, the longer they're getting that chance.
Amen to that.
Pretty interesting season coming up here. So anyway, tell us a little bit about your professional experience.
Yeah, so I've been in the larger sports media world in and around Chicago for more than the last decade. First kind of big event that I covered was the NFL draft in 2002, when the Indianapolis Colts selected Dwight Freeney in the first round. But over the past decade, I've covered pretty much everything from the NFL draft to Stanley Cup finals to Major League Baseball postseasons, the Ryder Cup, golf. I've done some soccer, which required some quick tutorials over cigars from my soccer playing friends so that I didn't refer to the field and the game instead of the pitch in the match. But I have covered just about everything. Own a Blackhawks website, committedindians.com. I've written for ChicagoNow.com, which is a Chicago Tribune-owned blog site, for more than a decade. And I write for the Fourth Period magazine up in Canada as well. I've written about just about everything, and I'm a very active fantasy sports guy. Lots of stuff going on. I was also involved in the launch of La Vida Baseball, which is a partnership between the Baseball Hall of Fame and an agency in Chicago that celebrates Latino culture through the lens of baseball. So lots of hockey, lots of football, lots of baseball, and just about everything else.
Well, good news for you. We're going to talk some football tonight, so we're going to lean on you for your perspective and your history of being able to write all this stuff down and bring it to the crowd. So if you're all right with that,
yeah,
let's go ahead and drop the green flag. NFL draft. So considering that it was supposed to be in one of the biggest venues it's ever been in Las Vegas up to this point, now we finally gotten word that this is strictly going to be digital, virtual, however you want to look at it. So I guess my question is to you guys, is there any downside to this, of it not being in its normal format?
I think it's a wild card because they can kind of create a format, and there's going to be so much just blank space for them to fill in the sports media ecosystem that anything that isn't a rerun of something that happened in the 90s is going to, or someone screaming about LeBron or Michael. By the middle of April, there's going to be such a, just an overwhelming appetite for new sports, anything, that they really can't go wrong unless they don't have cameras with the players. And I think that they'll be able to figure that out. You have to remember, this is a hundreds of billions of dollars organization, the NFL, that can probably figure out a way to wire a GoPro into Tua's house. The draft is half the time anyway, right? Yeah. I mean, a lot of guys don't even go because they don't want to be Aaron Rodgers and sit there and look depressed all night and then kill the Bears for 20 years. like literally Aaron Rodgers' face for the last 20 picks is the Bears for the last 20 years. The NFL draft, there's so much drama with the trades that happen in it and crazy GMs maneuvering their way up and down that it's always some of the best theater in sports television anyway. And I think the fact that the kids aren't there and you're not going to have a lot of team representatives on the floor, you're going to get a lot more action going on. And we might actually finally get to see Mel Kiper's head explode, which would be awesome. And just imagine like a pile of smoke or that luscious quaff.
Zab, you think they're going to do like a whole different format, or you think they're still going to try to do, you know, Goodell come up there as someone, you know, in behind the stage booing to keep it authentic for the last few years? And then, you know, is it?
I was just about to ask that. Is anybody else upset because nobody can actually do a verbal booing of
That's why the rumor started that the Houston Astros created the coronavirus so that they couldn't be
get the media off them.
The fact that nobody can boo Goodell is kind of sucks, but he'll get his every other year that he's the commissioner. Absolutely. And I'm sure that they'll just put it somewhere that he can get it twice as much next year. realistically, like the only thing that could have made this NFL draft bigger than having it in Vegas is the fact that it's the only sports anything for anybody to talk about the entire month of April.
Gotta say, while I'm disappointed, I'll get to see the guys float out to the little, stadium that they're going to build out on the water in Vegas. No matter what the NFL does, it's going to be a hit just because fans are so thirsty and hungry for something to do with sports other than just reruns of old games. They're going to love it. It's probably going to be one of the top watched drafts of all time.
Oh, yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how teams are innovating with cameras, you know, in the war rooms with obviously 10 or less people in most places. See how well followed that's going to be. But yeah, get to see team headquarters and GMs and everything behind the scenes that normally cameras would be focused on the players in the green room. So that'll be a good twist.
For gonna have to do
the,
okay, so as they go
six people or 10 people, 6 feet apart.
So as they do that and they've got these families, just think about some of the guys that have gone in the first round that didn't sit in the green room, or maybe the second round. They do a shot in that house and it'll be like a 1,000 to 1,200 square foot house, maybe bigger, but it looks like they're packed in a cage.
Yeah.
I mean, just wall to wall people.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to say, if you think there's going to be any less of that this go around, you're crazy.
Well, think about Joe Burrow, who grew up in the state of Ohio, presumably going to the Cincinnati Bengals with the number one overall pick. Like, he's going to have 500 tents for 10, 6 feet apart on, like, his entire block so that people can party with him. You know, the one positive byproduct for NFL front offices with this getting moved and being the way that it plays out, if you've been around as they've gone to different cities and you've seen the crowds, the one thing that not a lot of people think about is these players that go in the first round that go to the city and go up and walk on stage, they're there pretty much from like Wednesday until Saturday with their family. Well, that means that they've got to find something to do once they get drafted. And when the draft was in Chicago, I saw a couple guys, you know, hanging out outside of the Hilton downtown, like double fisting cigarettes at 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. And, you know, guys, you know, walking into Chicago Cut and asking them for the thickest cut of meat that they've got on the menu. And literally it's like a 3-ring binder comes out that somehow was part of an animal at some point. So the guys go out and do a bunch of stuff because they don't have to run fast anymore. They don't have to be the slimmest guy in the world anymore. Now they know where they're going. Somebody committed to them. They're going to sign a contract because it isn't like any of this is tiered by money like it was with Eli Manning balking at going to San Diego. So you know what? You pretty much have a good idea of what I'm going to get paid, how long I'm going to get paid for, where I'm going. So he checks all the boxes. The number of front office executives that were undoubtedly staying up nights already wondering if the guy they drafted in the first round was going to do something stupid from a personal conduct perspective because he was in Vegas and just became a millionaire, at least in theory, has to be comforting for a lot of these GMs that they don't have to worry about TMZ finding their guy in a strip club or something at 3 a.m. the night before the draft. They just have to worry about the videos of them wearing a gas mask at a frat party 7 months before.
That was an excellent point.
So with this being a very odd way that they've done this, pro days have been canceled. You know, I think that's been one of the, and we've actually seen a lot of these players kind of skip the pro days. Like Chase Young came straight out and said, I'm not doing it. So with this draft, is there potentially going to be an issue with basically people looking off of game tape only versus seeing what these guys have got between end of season and draft time?
Well, there certainly has to be. You know, for the guys being drafted in the top 3 rounds, I don't think it's a big deal for them. They already know essentially in rough area where they're going. But for the 6th, 7th round guys, the undrafted free agents, missing that pro day is probably a big deal for them. They don't have those scouts coming to see what improvements they made for the end of the season, talk to coaches in person, talk to staff, see how they work. So for the bottom feeder guys, I think that pro day is going to be hurtful in a sense. But yeah, for the top, I don't know, 60, 90 picks, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference either way.
Yeah, I mean, the hardest thing is this. Yeah, and there are always guys from non-Power 5 schools who end up getting drafted at some point, making a huge impact. And you see that there are guys from schools that you've never heard of. You know, Kyle Duggar is one of the top 3-4 safeties that'll probably get called off the board. You probably never heard of where he went to school. You've got Adam Trautman, who's a tight end from Dayton. You've got Matt Pert is a pretty good-sized offensive tackle from UConn. You know, and those are just a few guys that could be like, you know, depending on how much a guy falls in love with him, a late 2nd to end of 5th round pick. And when you don't have a pro day and some of these guys don't get invited to the combine or don't work out at the combine for any number, or heaven forbid, don't perform well at the combine, then you're relying on game tape. And if you're playing at a lower level or you're playing against okay competition, but it's not Alabama Clemson, I think you're going to see a lot of the bigger name school products see their draft stock improve, just because you assume when you watch a wide receiver beat a corner from Ohio State, or you watch, you know, a running back, you know, juke a linebacker at Purdue or Texas, there's kind of an assumption of right or wrong. There's an assumption of in better value at the position of what, whoever the guy is. And you don't know if a guy looks fast. He might be running a 4.65, but he's beating every corner in his league because every corner in that league runs a 4.8, or he could be running a 4.4. It could be legit. And so that's the problem, is you're going to see a lot of these smaller school guys have question marks on their draft stock because there's no way to evaluate them in an apples-to-apples scenario with a straight-up 40 and get all of these measurements, because that's really how they level the playing field. They watch you run a 40 in a pair of spandex shorts and say, okay, you're a 4.4, and then they go watch your game tape and see how your speed truly or your strength truly translates onto the field. Because you could be faster than anything and not be able to run routes, Devin Hester, and find a purpose, but not be a wide receiver. you know? And mm-hmm. so that's where you're going to see some of this stuff show up. And it also just the number of trades that have been made already, and the number of teams that have multiple compensatory picks, like New England's got two at the end of the third round. So I think Baltimore's got a couple, Minnesota's got a couple. So you've got a lot of teams that Philadelphia, I think, has two at the end of the fourth round back to back. So you've got a lot of teams that have a lot of draft picks and could maneuver their way around the draft. And you'll find out which GMs really did a good job scouting, which scouting departments really put the miles in and went and found these guys at smaller schools or watched the tape and really evaluated it well, because that's all you're going to have to base it on this year is you've got the limited number of guys that went to the combine, and then you're going to have game tape, or you actually sat there and watched the guy in person and you've got a scout that can tell you, I watched him. I believe that his speed or strength or whatever is going to translate at the next level. And the really tricky thing too, is with the quarterbacks, that's one of the hardest things. You know, they love to watch these guys throw because then they can hand them more intricate routes and get more one-on-one time with them, whether it's at the combine or if it's at a pro day. And the fact that you're really going to be limited, especially with Tua not doing the combine, to what you can really get. So it'll be interesting to see at the quarterback position, and then you got the wide receivers and corners where you don't necessarily always know what the speed is until you actually watch them on the game, if it translates right, or know if it's honest, how well they play in the games. But then the smaller school guys are just going to get crushed by it. And I think that there's going to be a lot of really, really good value for smart GMs starting even in the third round with guys that slide, because not every team, I don't think, has scouts that are going to do the legwork and go out and see those smaller school guys. Hopefully the Bears didn't go out and look at small school guys, so they don't come in with the cutest pick in the draft and end up with, you know, they've got two picks in the first four rounds. So here comes another Adam Shaheen.
Yeah. First round. Oh, geez.
If you hear breaking glass, I'm finding a third floor window to jump out of.
You and me both. Is there anything that's going to
Mitch Trubisky?
I'm still holding out. I'm still holding the faith. I don't know.
Yeah, you're the only one.
If you're holding, you could get a job as the Bears' right tackle.
Oh, that's true too. You know, we need a little offensive help.
I'm signing up.
Grab jersey.
Pay me.
Is there anything that stops these guys from doing, you know, with these quote unquote private workouts, or releasing, you know, workout films essentially to try to combat the fact there's no pro day? I mean, is there anything from a rule standpoint that you guys are aware of that keeps that from happening?
No. You could drop that all over YouTube if you really wanted
YouTube,
the attention.
Twitter,
I mean, if you're a small town guy, or if you, you're coming off an injury, you know, late season, something like that, you got to prove that ACL is still worth the damn or something like that, then that could be an option as well to try to get a little hype going, get a little follower nation going.
I mean, the Bears have got a running back who is a YouTube sensation on the roster right now from a historically black college who is undersized for pretty much anything other than maybe being a winger in the National Hockey League. And he got himself drafted, and he's been a Pro Bowler, and he's turning it into a really nice career because of YouTube. Here's the problem for the smaller school guys, though, is a lot of the really good quality tape that people are going to buy into, or the binders that teams will get and the really deeper look at tape, a lot of that stuff's going to be paid for and produced by an agent. And there isn't a long list of agents that have the resources available to crank that stuff out that are lining up to go find somebody from a D2 school or a historically black college and university. Like, there aren't. And if you can find a grinder, if you can find that Jerry Maguire out there that's willing to invest in you as an individual, that's tremendous. But having a large number of those prospects get invested in and send that stuff out to teams is just going to be tough to do. And so that's where it gets to be hard. And again, watching someone hold a stopwatch and have you run a 4 or 5 is one thing, but then you'd have to cut a full highlight reel so that they can see how that then translates. Because I'm sure that every one of these kids that feels like he's going to be picked in the first 4 rounds, a lot of their measurables are going to be known by the GMs. But what you said earlier about those guys that slide to the 5th, 6th, 7th round, those are the guys that aren't going to have a lot of agents lining up to put together a lengthy brief with their life history and their highlight reels, because those guys aren't guaranteed roster spots, and the agent isn't guaranteed to really make anything off of the client other than chasing a roster spot, whether it be on a practice squad or a bench spot earlier in their career, unless you find an absolute gem and the guy blows up. So it is going to be tough. And I think that the other spot where GMs and scouts are really going to make their money is when those really good players slide and don't hear their name called in the seven rounds of the draft. I think you're going to have a lot of quality on the floor, on the scrap heap, if you will, for teams to go sign as undrafted free agents. And I think that you're going to see a huge uptick in the quality of players and the impact from undrafted free agents this year, because there might be guys that everybody keeps tucked in their back pocket that no one's heard of, but you'd rather have the guy that spent 3 years at Alabama and transferred out because he was at Alabama, which means he's good, you know, than the guy that went to an NAIA school or a D3 school who might have all the measurables in the world and has great game tape, but you can't really quantify it. So you take a chance on him as an undrafted free agent instead of committing to the guy in any way, shape, or form. So you're going to see which organizations have their crap together real quick in August, assuming anything happens by August.
Well, and I think that's something important to think about. Even when I played college, it was like, I'm not going to toot my horn at all here, but you know, you look at some of these guys that are coming out in like the fourth round, and as an NAIA athlete, I have most of the same, as you said, quantifiables as they do. I got the same bench, same 40 times, same weight class, same, you know, this, that, and the other. I didn't want to go because I had too many injuries, but you know, there's a lot of room to pick up, as you said. And I'm kind of curious at this point, how many workouts they can have or how they set that up, because I've never researched it. Just because of this year, once you get just before preseason, so you've got these, you know, unsigned guys that you can bring in to get looks at, how many workouts are they going to hold to, you know, attempt to pick up a couple roster spots? Because that really is going to put pressure on your later round draft guys. You could really make a competition now.
Yeah. Well, usually you have teams will have some type of a training camp around the time of the draft. And that's especially critical for new coaches with new teams. So the Ron Rivera's in Washington, getting to know his team, getting to know what he has, especially with a young quarterback who, you know, Washington may or may not be still in the Dwayne Haskins boat. I think they are. I think they'd be nuts to take a shot on a kid in this draft when I think Haskins would be probably the second quarterback or third quarterback off the board this year, especially with Tua's leg injury. But yeah, I mean, with new coaches, usually they'll have some type of a workout for a couple days before the draft just so that they can gauge what exactly they've got. No, let's put all the cards on the table and see what we've got, and then you go shopping. And then the coach can be part of that process after seeing his team function. And then usually there's a rookie camp that comes after the draft where they have all the rookies in and whatever undrafted free agents, and that's where they get, you know, memorize the playbook overnight and then go perform on no sleep. Type scenarios, but that, and you'll have some young guys come in, and you know, in a case like Washington, you might have Haskins come throw if you end up with receivers or whatnot. But you know, that is going to be huge, because when you've got new quarterbacks with, you know, changing teams, familiarity with the system is going to be huge, and you can't just a lot of systems you can't just walk in and function from day one. It's a totally new language. It is a totally new system. You've got different guys that you're throwing to. You can't develop that rapport overnight. So I think the fact that like a Tom Brady going to Tampa, where he's got veteran, old school offensive coaches around him and a lot of, you know, relatively seasoned skill position guys. Mike Evans isn't a rookie. You know, Chris Godwin was terrific last year, and I think he's just going to get better. But no, I think him going there, he'll be able to work with Arians and get their heads together pretty quickly about what are we doing? and what do I need to know? And he's old enough that it's not going to take him forever to learn stuff. But when you've got a new offensive system going in with a young quarterback, that's going to be tough. And I think that's what played into a situation like the Chicago Bears trading for Nick Foles. He knows the offensive coaches. He knows the language. He knows the play system. So when he comes in, he's going to be able to jump in. And even if he's speaking, you know, let's say he's speaking Mexican Spanish instead of Spain Spanish, he's still speaking a level of Spanish that he's going to be able to pick it up pretty quickly. And so there might be some nuances to the terminology, but Foles will be able to pick it up in Chicago a lot easier than maybe a Cam Newton would, because Cam Newton's coming out of a different system where he's been his entire career. And so that's, I think, what played into some organizations making their decisions about quarterbacks, because they're going to have limited opportunities to get these guys working before training camp starts. And right now, we don't know when training camp is going to open. I think we all hope that by the end of July, life is back to somewhat normal, but we have no guarantee of that. So I think a lot of what they're doing is, you know, shooting blanks in the dark, praying that the NFL season goes off without a hitch and they can live in the only sports vacuum possible where they don't get enormously affected from a on-field perspective. But they're going to be affected on field by not being able to work these guys as much as they would like before the season starts.
So basically we have the opportunity to see some crash and burn, some, you know, explosions, some actual good things. It just kind of depends on how long they wait to put them in face masks, under the face mask, and wear, you know, receiver gloves with surgical gloves underneath.
Well, and what's going to be I think the most interesting part of all of this is which coaches are going to actually make their guys go out there and get more reps in the preseason. Because a lot of coaches, and we keep going back to Chicago, but the Bears didn't play their offensive starters, you know, more than like a dozen snaps the entire preseason, not in a game, the entire preseason. They basically sat it out and then they came out and crapped the bed the first week. And so, you know, you've got the want to keep them healthy, but you also have the know what the hell you're doing when it counts. And so that's where the preseason is going to be fascinating this year, is who gets out, who gets how many reps, and which coaches can be comfortable with the amount of reps that their first teams get, and which coaches don't know what they're doing. Because I think clearly Chicago missed the mark last year. It's not Tom Brady, you know, getting 12 snaps because he's been there for 20 years. This is a third-year starting quarterback who needs to figure stuff out. So you're going to look at teams that have young quarterbacks, that have new quarterbacks in new situations, have new offensive linemen, got a lot of moving pieces there. And there are going to be some defenses that are going to need to work on it too, but it's a little bit like easier on defense and offense, because different position groups are going to communicate well within themselves. But yeah, it's going to be the number of dynamics that are moving still for the NFL are mind numbing beyond the draft, much less who gets picked where and how that changes the livelihoods of a whole lot of people, both established veterans and these young kids that are going to go see their dream realized without going on stage in Vegas.
So speaking of which, let's go ahead and move over just a little bit. Let's talk about the top couple prospects that we think are going to happen. I mean, even if you skip prospects right now, you've got Cincinnati leading number one, who's had literally the worst offensive season they've ever had. I shouldn't say offense, but worst season they've ever had. And production on the offense was more of a run and gun just out of necessity than it was anything else. Do they do anything other than Joe Burrow?
So here's the rock and the hard place for Cincinnati. Quarterbacks win games, and Joe Burrow is a tremendous prospect. So they should absolutely take Joe Burrow, because you need a quarterback to win. And while people can say Chase Young is the best edge rushing prospect we've seen in a while, people have said that about a defensive end from Ohio State like three of the last 4 years. So, so you have this is the reality in the NFL now. You have freak athletes that come out every year that are crazy good. Cincinnati could take Chase Young, and Andy Dalton could get killed again, and they could end up tanking again and have Trevor Lawrence fall in their lap in 12 months. At which point AJ Green is gone probably. Everyone else on their team is a year older. And you have no guarantee that someone else doesn't end up worse than you. And you actually get Trevor Lawrence, or Trevor Lawrence stays healthy. So you have to take what you can get. You have to go with the known commodities. The biggest issue for Cincinnati isn't Joe Burrow falling into their lap at number one. It's who does he have around him and how do they protect him? I think, you know, having the top pick in each round is great because you can generally have some good value there. But at the same time, Cincinnati is not a team that has a lot of other picks. I mean, they basically are sitting at the top of each round and that's all they've got. So they have limited draft capital. And the really tricky thing is going to be if you're Cincinnati and Miami offers you all three of their first round picks for Joe Burrow, do you do that? Do you move down to five and add 18 and 26 to the mix? And then the crapshoot is, will Tua be there at five? Are you enamored with one of Justin Herbert or Jordan Love at five if someone comes and gets Tua? But is it worth trading out of the number one to for a team like – and I think Miami's the only one because they have a top five pick. I think Burrow's enough of a prospect right now that you're looking at an Elway-type situation. And I'm not saying that Joe Burrow is John Elway, but I think that his stock is so high and Cincinnati is such a need at the position that you would have to get multiple first-round picks and something that's high. And the only team with multiple ones that's drafting highly is Miami. Would you trade the number one overall for three first-rounders? If I'm Cincinnati, I think long and hard about trading the number one overall to Miami for all three, because then you'd be able to get a couple offensive linemen with him, maybe get a skill position guy to go with him. But I think if Cincinnati stays put at one, they take Burrow and then they look at addressing, protecting him and who he gets the ball to in the rounds that follow because they desperately need to do that. AJ Green can't be happy because one, he keeps getting banged up and two, he keeps getting banged up because there's nobody around him. TJ Houshmandzadeh is not walking through that door. So they need to give Burrow someone to throw it to. They need to protect him. And I think that they can accomplish that. But unless you do something amazing and Miami pulls a Ditka and offers you their three first-round picks for number one, I think you said put and take Burrow.
Yeah, for a second there, I was thinking, like, you know, is there any way in hell that the Patriots try to get up there into the top five? But, I mean, they're – while they have, what, 12 picks, I think, unfortunately, I mean, they really don't get rolling until the third round. So I don't know if they would have anything to give up to try to get themselves up there and try to grab a quarterback. You know, and there's rumors that, you know, Hurts could potentially be there at a later pick as well. So, yeah, that's going to be interesting.
And the Patriots have a lot of holes that they need to fill. They've had enormous defections. Frankly, they feel a lot like they're in full-blown rebuild mode right now because they have had so many players leave. And so, it, you know, they're – I don't think that they would – I don't consider New England to be in a position to trade up to one because they'd be getting a quarterback and have nothing else. And that's not how Belichick rolls. And Belichick has to replace Jamie Collins. He's got to replace Kyle Van Noy. He's got to replace Danny Shelton. Need to find a kicker. They need, frankly, somebody to protect whoever's behind center. And then they got to have somebody for the quarterback to throw to because, let's be honest, Tom Brady'd probably still be there if he wasn't looking around at God knows what for wide receivers and no tight end to replace Gronk. I mean, he had very limited. And remember, everybody was laughing at the beginning of the season when they brought in Antonio Brown because they're like, look at all these receivers. Tom Brady's going to throw for 12,000 yards this year. And then they trade one to the Jets and Antonio Brown goes crazy. And Kenyal Harry ends up being a mild bust because he missed the first half of the season with an injury. And Tom Brady's got nothing to throw to. So I feel like the Patriots would be nuts to even if they could package something, which I don't think they can, but even if they could package something, make a jump, I don't think that they would, just because I think they're in rebuild mode, and I think they need to have as many picks as they can to try and get depth back everywhere, because they've lost so many players this year in free agency.
Obviously, my dog agrees. So the joys of being in temporary housing and trying to record a podcast. But yeah, no, that's an excellent point.
So, okay, we go back to Cincinnati. Because I think the other thing you have to look at is you've got an issue with your fan support. You bring in Joe Burrow, the locals are all going to be super happy, because I can tell you right now, after he won the national championship, I happened to drive through his hometown, and I mean, it was just boards everywhere. The home of, like, that was their one thing that they're super excited about, which they should be. But if they trade him out, which to me would be their smartest play, as you said, they have so many holes right now, and you know, Andy Dalton isn't necessarily done. He just needs somebody to actually block for half a second to get rid of the ball. And they could pick up a solid offensive tackle, solid wide receiver, you know, and then potentially trade one of those spots away to get a couple more picks in the second or third round. But you've also got a group that out of the same state of Cleveland, that they're Cleveland's totally happy, unhappy all year long with going 0-for in a season and then putting out special beer cans and celebrating. Okay. So they're as happy and unhappy, they'll still show up. I don't think Cincinnati fans will do that. They want that Houdet spirit. I still don't get that, but they want all of that playing through there, and they want to have something that's going to make them want to come to games, want to make them watch games. So if you turn down Joe Burrow as the front office staff, are you nervous about who you pick up at that
point? The good thing for the Bengals is there are the top two picks in this draft are really no question. It's either Joe Burrow from Ohio or Chase Young from Ohio. So it's a win-win for Cincinnati. Either, unless they trade down to 5, at which point they would be passing on Burrow and Young. Again, Cincinnati has a ton of holes to fill, but I think you get a quarterback, you use the picks after that to protect him and get him some weapons. This is an insanely deep draft at wide receiver. Insane. You're going to have legit number one, number two receivers going in the third and fourth round this year. So you can fill some of those positions later on in the draft. Also remember, they take Burrow number one. There are going to be teams that don't get the quarterback that they want in the first or second round, who then might be looking at offering you something in the third round for Andy Dalton. So there's still the ability for them to maneuver some of their veteran pieces at the draft. And I could very, very easily see a scenario with New England having 3 picks in the third round. If New England calls and says, hey, we'll give you the 100th overall pick for Andy Dalton. Bye, Andy. It's been real. You know? And then he goes and becomes one of the 5 40-something-year-old quarterbacks in New England this year. But that's one of those things where, like, I could very easily see, a team like, you know, even Pittsburgh, if they've got questions about whether or not Big Ben's going to be right at the beginning of the season, Pittsburgh's got a comp pick in the third round. That might be a play. Even if it's a fourth or a fifth rounder, again, there's so much depth in the skill positions this year and so much depth on the defensive side of the ball that I think you're going to see people really fall in love with wide receivers and defensive players. And you're going to see a lot of your offensive linemen and your running backs and tight ends sliding into the fourth and the fifth rounds. But yeah, I think that Cincinnati can maneuver after that. The wild card is, do they take Chase Young number one overall under the hope and prayer that one of, or both of, Jacob Eason and Jake Fromm slide out of the first round? Because I think both of those guys are going to be available when the 33rd pick is on the board. I think you're going to have four quarterbacks go in the first round, and I think Eason and Fromm are going to slide out of the first round. So that's the crapshoot for Cincinnati is if you don't see a significant – if you think that Chase Young and Jacob Eason is better than Joe Burrow and TBD, then maybe that's what you do. But I don't think – there are so many moving parts in the 31 selections after number one. I think you take Burrow, and if somebody gets – if Eason and Fromm are both on the board at 33 – you just won the lottery because somebody's going to need a quarterback, Indianapolis, Detroit. And if they don't take them in the first round, now there's going to be a scramble to get in front of Indianapolis and Detroit to get one of those guys. And now you've got some draft capital that you can play with. So I go Burrow. I don't lose any sleep over it. Chase Young's going to be a real good player in the NFL. If he plays at a Bosa level, which I think most people are, whether it's because he's from Ohio State or just because they're both so damn good. But I think most people are making that comp. If he plays at that level, especially for Ron Rivera, the Redskins will be real happy. But I don't think Cincinnati, from a PR perspective, loses by taking Joe Burrow at number one as long as they protect him. And that's why it's critical that they find a way to improve their offensive line between now and game one.
Okay, so first round tends to be that crazy round. I'm going to skip something in just interesting point that's been running through my mind here. We've talked about a couple of the big names that are going to be right at the top, which if Washington gets Chase Young, you know, they become Ohio State junior at this point, but or I guess senior in the NFL. So my question is to you guys, is there a team that you could see trading up in the first round to try and get pick out of these top maybe five guys?
I think Detroit is in a position to get the heck out of three and move down and add picks. Detroit had a really good free – Detroit did really well in free agency. And I frankly, I think they did the best job of any team in – NFC Norris, as we like to call it. But old school hockey reference, you're welcome. No, but when you look at what they've been able to do bringing in, I mean, they got rid of Darius Slay, but they replaced him. They brought in Jamie Collins and Desmond Trufant. Jamie Collins is a beast. Desmond Trufant is a terrific corner, and he's cheaper than Darius Slay. They brought in Danny Shelton from New England. So you've got a situation where they've added a lot. They've addressed a lot of the massive issues that they had. So they've done a nice job there. I think if they could move down, and if Detroit could get maybe Oakland's two picks because they want to go get a young buck to push Derek Carr, if they could get San Francisco, who, you know, remember San Francisco picked up the 13th overall pick from Indianapolis in a big deal for DeForest Buckner. They've got two first round picks. I think that a lot of people are going to look at the New York Giants and say they're going to take one of Isaiah Simmons or Jeff Okuda, whichever one's available. I think they should take an offensive tackle, but I think most people are looking at the Giants doing either the top corner or the top linebacker on the board. A lot of people think Detroit should draft a quarterback because Matthew Stafford is not going to last forever. Again, I am living in a world where I believe that both Eason and Fromm are going to be available in the second round, and Detroit could address that there. Detroit could and should probably take an offensive tackle with their first pick to protect Matthew Stafford and what's left of him. But if they could have a second first-round pick and go get another wide receiver or a tight end, or something else to help the defense, they'd have to think about that. And I think you're looking at a scenario now, again, coming back to the Chicago Bears and them trading up for Mitchell Trubisky. They believed that teams wanted Trubisky, and other teams have admitted that they were enamored with Trubisky, and they felt like they had to get in front of Washington to get him. They had to move up that one spot because there was pressure to get him, and they didn't think that he'd make it past two. I think a lot of people are firmly believing that Miami will not – that the second quarterback will not be available by 6. And a lot of people feel like Miami and the Chargers are both in a position to take a quarterback at 5 and 6. So if you want one of the top 3 quarterbacks in the draft, you've got to be picking in the top 4. And that's what makes Detroit so fascinating, because I think that they could really help themselves and have done a great job in free agency by moving down and getting quality at multiple places. And with the 3rd overall pick, they'd be able to probably get 2 1s and a future 1, or 2 1s and a 2. In a draft that's deep in a lot of places, and really, really make some hay and really look at making some noise in that division this year. And so I look at Detroit at 3 as a situation where, unless they fall head over heels in love with either Okuda or one of the top offensive tackles, I think Detroit's in a great position to help themselves and move down. And they've been smart enough in free agency that I think that they're thinking that way anyway. If they were head over heels in love with Simmons, they probably would not have brought in Jamie Collins. If they were head over heels in love with Okuda, they might have stayed with Darius Slay and gone with a rookie next to Slay as his eventual replacement. So I think the fact that they brought in Trufant, they brought in Collins, leads you to believe that they're addressing some of the areas where defensively they'd be able to add at 3. So them either going offensive line at 3 or trading down makes the most sense. So Detroit, I think the whole draft changes on Detroit. If they take Tua, everybody hangs their phone up and, you know, goes out and has a cigarette and figures out what the hell just happened. If they take an offensive tackle like Tristan Wirfs or Jedrick Willis at 3, it makes sense. But that pushes a lot of value down the board, and they could have gotten one of those two guys probably – at 7, 9, 10, something like that. So Detroit's going to – I think the whole thing shifts at 3 based on what Detroit does.
See, I'm almost wondering if Atlanta does something crazy where they're going to trade up to potentially pick up Okuda. If he's really – if he gets past 3 or 4, I would be surprised. But they could easily find a way to trade up for that, because I think they're going to need – a defensive back.
I see that as well. Here's the thing with the cornerbacks this year. I think you probably got 6 or 7 that are like legit, mm-hmm. can play a lead corner in the NFL type guys. I think you might have 3 of them go in the first round. So if you're Atlanta, you're sitting at 16 and 48. Which cornerbacks might still be on the board for you at 48 if at 16 you decide to do one of 3 things. Bring in another wide receiver to take some of the weight off Julio. Bring in an offensive lineman to protect Matt Ryan. Or the corner. Or for me, the wild card with Atlanta is, are they a team that surprises everybody at 16 overall and takes a guy like DeAndre Swift? Because Atlanta's running back situation has been a dumpster fire for a while. You watched one of their two-headed monsters a couple years ago play and get hurt with the 49ers this year, and they punted the other one. So do they do something crazy and go get a workhorse running back at 16, or do they go running back at 48? They are a team that's fascinating because there are so many different ways that they could go. I think if you've got Jerry Jeudy or CeeDee Lamb available at 16, frankly, if T. Higgins is still there at 16, it's really hard for me to say don't take another A-plus wide receiver to couple with Julio. Because by 16, I think you're going to have probably 4 offensive tackles off the board. And then Atlanta could very easily be looking at like a Trevon Diggs, Christian Fulton, type corner, even maybe a Jeff Gladney from TCU. Those are 3 corners that could probably step in and make an impact for them on the defensive side of the ball in the second round at 48, that they wouldn't have to necessarily jump. And I'm not a big CJ Henderson guy. So that's why I'm not like sprinting out the door to be like, hey, let's go take the number 1 corner in the draft. And there are enough like game changing wide receivers that if you put a Jeudy or a Lamb or a Higgins opposite Julio, God bless. Like, now you're talking about in a dome having game changers on either side of the ball. And so that's where I would probably lean with Atlanta. I think 48 is a place that they could go for corner. And also, you know, dumpster diving. There are still going to be guys that get waived A lot of personnel stuff is still sorting out. So I could see them dumpster diving for some value at corner or acquiring a veteran, moving a pick maybe later in the day, maneuvering their way around next year's draft as well. But I, if I'm Atlanta, I'm keeping an eye on the movement at the wide receiver position and trying to throw Julio Bone there.
Okay, so as we're getting later into the show here, real quick, I definitely wanted to take a few minutes to go over your book. So Tab has written a book as his time in Chicago called The 100 Things Blackhawk Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, which, as we talked about, you said sold out the first run you had. So it was obviously pretty popular because it's still selling pretty good numbers.
Yeah, so it initially came out in 2011 in time for the 2011-12 season. So the Blackhawks were one season removed from their first Stanley Cup in almost 50 years. And then they subsequently won two more. So God bless, we ended up with a dynasty. Good time for marketing. So it's on its third edition now. I had to update it a couple times after they won a second and third Stanley Cups. Life could be worse. It's still moving. I still have people reach out to me for signed copies, ask me questions about the writing process, which was a little different for me at that time. I had 7 weeks to write it, so I turned it around in five. So it was a little bit of a sprint putting a book together in basically a little over a month, but it was a lot of fun to work on. And if you enjoy history, I think it's a really good bite-sized way to go back through the history of the Blackhawks and some stuff maybe not every fan considers off the beaten path, places that you can go and things that you could do as a Blackhawks fan to kind of celebrate your fandom of the team.
That's really cool. Is there any other, outside of updating it, are there any other thoughts you've had on writing another book or a different team in the area?
I have a second book in the works that is scheduled to come out in time for, knock on wood, if there is a 2021 NHL season. I should have another Blackhawks book coming out in the fall. So we'll have to circle back when that thing is ready to hit shelves. Again, knock on wood again. Heck that yeah. We have an on-time, full, regularly scheduled NHL season or something that looks like that. But I should have a second book about the Blackhawks coming out in September or October of this year.
You guys know what to get me for Christmas, so just go ahead and write that down.
Is there any – put it on your Amazon list.
I'll take
Maybe
it.
Maybe I can have it sent up there and signed for you.
I guess
I just said
I've got a guy. We can work that out.
I got a guy.
There you go.
I love that term. I got a guy.
We'll do lunch. Is there anything else about your book or any, like, what was your most fun thing in the book, your favorite part? I'm sure you get asked that a lot, but, you know, just while we're talking about it, is there anything else you'd throw out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the first time that you write a book, it's pretty daunting. A lot of people who enjoy writing, you know, will throw the idea of writing a book someday out there. So actually writing it was daunting to start and then a lot of fun to work on. It was a bit of a sprint. Working with Jeremy Roenick, who was kind enough to provide the foreword for me, was terrific. I've had a number of conversations with him since, and he is just, he's one of really the most outgoing guys who's just passionate about hockey, sometimes to a fault. But he was great to work with on the forward. And I think, you know, the fun thing about updating it too is that as things changed, you know, looking at it, it's been a unique decade for the Chicago Blackhawks. And so from the first edition to 4 years later, having a dynasty edition come out after they've won three Stanley Cup championships, watching how the guys on the current team, the core guys, elevated themselves in their place in the history of one of the original six franchises and how it went from, okay, these guys have got one cup, they're 23 years old, let's see what they got in the long run, to Okay, Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews and Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook and Marian Hossa are now, you know, legitimately in the conversation for Mount Rushmore in Chicago Blackhawks history. And, you know, then they end up being among the top 100 players as voted on in NHL history. And so kind of living through that, watching these young players ascend in their historical significance and trying to capture that was a lot of fun to work on. So if you have it, hope you enjoy it. If you don't, please go buy it and let me know what you think.
Yeah, be sure to put the links in the description there.
We'll definitely, it was only
like
that,
a, for like sure, because like we'll get that ago, done this year. Duncan Keith, and now we don't even have hockey, so I am in full-blown depression mode at the moment. But, yeah, absolute legends in Chicago and around the country for sure. Jeez.
Well, and, you know, I think it's a great way to kind of wrap up our conversation about the NFL draft, because you look at teams like the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Chicago Blackhawks, and I think they are the models and they're both NHL teams, but I think they are the models that all of these teams that have started to tank have been chasing. The Houston Astros and the Chicago Cubs didn't make tanking a thing and didn't own the idea of bottoming out to become good until after Pittsburgh had won a Stanley Cup with Sidney Crosby and the Blackhawks had won multiple Stanley Cups with Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews. So I think what every team is dreaming of achieving is getting those high picks, picking a guy who's going to win it, and finding the face of your franchise, finding that future captain who you're going to be able to say, this is the guy. And that's what I think you look at these teams in the NFL are hoping for with their draft. When, you know, what we talked about with the Cincinnati Bengals, which guy are they going to be able to take at number one that they can say, this is our, whether it's Carlos Correa or Chris Bryant or Jonathan Toews or Sidney Crosby, which guy is going to lead us to the promised land that we're going to be able to put on every billboard in the city and say, this is the face of our franchise. And that's what that's why people are addicted to the NFL draft and other drafts. I don't think many people care about anything after like the seventh pick of the NBA draft anymore. But you know, there are writers who dig into and become draft addicts for baseball. And certainly the NHL has a huge draft following as well. But the NFL is where you see the most just neurotic following of which guy is going to be the face of the franchise. And when you look at what the Blackhawks have been able to do with their dynasty, what the Penguins have been able to do, all these NFL teams are looking for their Jonathan Toews, their Patrick Kane, or their Sidney Crosby. And that's what makes it fun. That's why we love the draft as much as we love watching those kids show up on Sunday and do their thing.
Absolutely. Well, Tab, we definitely want to thank you for coming on the show. Lots of amazing insight. You know, we'd love to have you back again because, I mean, you definitely have your history in all these sports and you know your stuff. So thank you so much for spending some time.
Absolutely. Anytime. Hope to chat with you guys again soon.
For sure. For now, we're going to go ahead and drop the yellow flag and get a quick sponsor break, and then we'll come back and talk some predictions in rapid fire. So, hold on for us just a minute. All right. Welcome back to our regular listeners and to any newbies that we have out there. We just got done doing an interview or some time with one of my colleagues, Tab Bamford. Wrote a book called 100 Things Blackhawk Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Definitely a great addition to any Blackhawk fans' shelves and experiences. They should be walking around kind of taking a look at this. So definitely catch up on the book. We highly recommend it. But at the same time, we definitely appreciate his time. He gave us a lot of great insights on NFL, some NHL, some MLB. So we'll have him back on another time to talk.
let's go ahead and move into our white flag. Currently, our prediction standings for season two are still on hiatus. So I don't know if it's really worth kind of reading off the scores at this point. But we have been having some fun with the rapid-fire questions. So far, I'm just going to say that I've been right on most of them, like, you know, Tom Brady and who is going to get the college MVP award. So just saying, David, you got some catching up to do?
Mm-hmm. No one's tracking these.
I got a clean slate, so.
It's true. Okay, so Chris, you're on the board. Let's get question number one. We should start playing some Jeopardy music as we wait for these. All right, here it comes. David, you're going to be up first on this. Cam Newton was officially released by the Panthers, but has not signed anywhere yet as of this recording. Where do you think he lands, and will he be a starter in 2020? Go.
Man, that is such a loaded question. I'm going to go with the LA Chargers. Phillip Rivers, the longstanding quarterback, is gone. Everybody knows Cam likes the limelight, so he's got the lore of LA. Hollywood's there, probably do some more commercials. Ownership needs a former MVP to come open up SoFi Stadium this fall. They have Tyrod Taylor, so I think he'd definitely compete. Probably take the starting job for him if he's healthy. If not, Tyrod Taylor will be the starter on day one. So LA Chargers.
Interesting. John, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, there's a couple of things out there like Bills and Chargers and Raiders and things like that. But originally, I'll be honest, I was thinking Raiders. But with their recent addition, looks like they've already gone down a different path for with Marcus Mariota going over there. So, yeah, I mean, I think if it's anywhere, I think it's either going to be the Chargers or some random team like the Patriots or something. It'll be a Belichick just – throwing something out there, although I can't see those two matching up really well. But I'll be honest, outside of really the Chargers, I don't see him being a starter anywhere. I think he's, you know, he's lost some of that game, and I don't know, who knows, maybe he's got a little chip on his shoulder. Maybe we'll get, you know, some of that old Cam Newton back from back in the day when he played with a little attitude and was running people over. So maybe that's what he needs, is kind of a change of scenery.
So I don't know that I see him as a starter, but there are a couple teams out there that are kind of rebuilding. So, as Dave said, the Chargers. I thought it was interesting that Tab kind of brought up New England, the fact that they're doing a complete rebuild. You know, he doesn't necessarily fit their system, but if they are doing a true rebuild, Belichick, you know, as well as guys, either you mold to the system or you're gone. And he's probably going to pick up a quarterback this year somewhere down the line. He's got a couple guys in backup, and he's got, what, Brian Hoyer? So, So I think he's got a good shot at the Pats. You know, he brings something a little different, and even if you don't get the Cam of old, if he is healed, they could certainly make a ground game available between their – running back committee, maybe run a – it's again, it's not necessarily Belichick, but run a pistol offense or a full house and be able to do some crazy things with that. So,
well,
I'm going to say New England.
If I'm a team looking at Cam Newton, I'm more worried about what's between the ears than I am between, you know, what's going on with ankles and shoulders and things like that. So, if he's mentally engaged, then I think you've got something there. But if he's – scorned and he's going to play with an attitude and become the next AV or Terrell Owens or something like that and just kind of try to be a publicity stunt sort of thing, at that point he might as well retire. But and I just don't know if I see him being a backup either. That's the other thing.
No, he's
I'm not a huge fan of Cam since the last Super Bowl he was in and getting all his injuries, and he's never truly recovered. But again, if you look at what the Ravens have done this year with having like Lamar Jackson, RG3, you know, throw a running back in the mix, and now you've got one heck of a crazy offense that you could run on, you know, certain downs just to throw off the defense. Belichick could run that if he really wanted to. So, you know, I think that Cam's whole deal was feeling crazy with his clothes more than, you know, going out there and talking a whole lot. He just
felt like he wanted to dress nice? Question mark. I don't know.
Look good, feel good. Feel good, play good.
Yeah, that's his own thing. That I would never look good, feel good in what he wears.
Well, he's got to get some more than his belt too, right? Because you know, that limits the options. I'm
sure there's a
you're not going to sell. Belt
he can order it online right now, like the rest of us right now.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Okay,
number two,
Chris, give us number two.
Tell Chris to hurry up.
John, you're going to be first up on this. A towel Kobe used in his last NBA game in 2016 just sold for $33,000. What's the most you spent on a sports memorabilia item, and what is it or what's on your wish list?
That's a good question. Probably the most that I've ever spent, and I don't want to say particularly out loud because my wife listens to this podcast and probably best
close your ears.
Don't open that
close
door.
Close your ears.
But I did spend a decent penny on a signed Patrick Kane. So we were talking about Blackhawks earlier. Patrick Kane, a shot of him lifting up the Stanley Cup when the Blackhawks won the cup at home at the United Center.
Okay.
So signed from him. It's all matted and framed and everything else. So you got the whole shebang done to it. So that's probably like the most that I've spent on it. I got some autographed baseballs and stuff, but yeah, probably total has been that autographed picture with Kane. And then my wish list, you know, we were down at Circuit of the Americas for the Formula One race. There was one of the helmet from Valentino Rossi,
yes.
the greatest MotoGP rider in history, and the doctor. They had a helmet for him that was signed, and if there was any way that I could have made that happen and not been killed when I got home, I would have. But who knows? Maybe this year, if we ever get the F1 race in the books, maybe I can go and find it again. But that thing was beautiful, and I would gladly take it home.
Mm. Nice. Well, I think Chris offered you the Ferrari engine block for like $20,000 or something when he was over there at one point.
Yep.
Since we had that kind of money to throw against
it. That podcast is blowing up, man.
Hey.
Dave, what about you? What's on your
So I think the most I've ever spent on memorabilia is probably my $75 bobblehead signed by Baron Davis from back in the day. I actually haven't spent a ton of money on memorabilia. I have a lot of things, but nothing crazy expensive.
Nothing wrong with that.
Probably best. However, I want to have some more room pretty soon, so I'm going to have to start getting some more stuff to fill it out. So that may change in the near future, but we'll keep some numbers under wrap of what I might want to spend.
Yeah, for those listeners out there, David's got himself going into a bigger place, building out a studio and a slash man cave. So looking forward to an invite once this social distancing is over for some BBQ.
Definitely.
There you go. So I've got two sides of this, I guess, based on his question. The most I ever spent, I'm kind of with David. I've never really spent a whole lot on the memorabilia side, but for the one time I did spend some money, not gifted to me, but spent, was probably on a Reggie White jersey when he was playing for the Panthers. You know, as a D lineman, that's what I wanted to play really bad growing up, and great guy, Christian guy, role model, and what an athlete. So, you know, I spent the 40, 50 bucks, whatever it was at the time, to buy a jersey. As for maybe my favorite piece, I think the favorite thing I've got is a basketball signed by Grant Hill and the rest of the national championship 91-92 team for Duke. My dad got that for me through a connection he had at the time. But if you ask me what like the one thing I think that I would love to have, oh gosh, maybe a Babe Ruth signed home run baseball, even though I'm not a big baseball guy. He was
offenses on that one.
Well, man.
I mean, we're dreaming here, right? It's like, you know, the question said, what's on your wish list? It's a wish list, not a, I'm going to go obtain it. I'm not a multimillionaire, billionaire, whatever. They could just go find one. But,
yeah, I thought my $1,000, $2,000 signed helmet was pushing it, but you're talking millions up there. Shoot.
Man.
Well, I mean, it'd be really cool to have like a tire off an F1 car or an engine head and be like, you know, I have an actual piece of Ferrari here. But, you know, I mean, if you're just talking about something neat memorabilia on a wish list, sure, I think that'd be a neat piece. We know a guy, I mean, we all know the guy that has what, the rookie collection of all the greats from the Yankees. And I think they're all signed, right? Shout out to one of our teachers from high school. Anybody?
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I think they're insured.
I think so.
Yeah, probably so.
I think so.
Okay. So, anyway, I mean, we're not going to mention names just in case, but I'm sure they're under some kind of like, you know, CIA built lock and key somewhere. Okay. Question three. Does this mean I should start then when he gets us across?
Yeah, you're up.
Yep.
Okay. You're up. What show are you currently binge watching while you're stuck at home?
Great question.
Interesting. Gosh, I've seen a couple. I'm going to say that the last one I watched, and again, for our younger viewers, I don't recommend this, but there's a TV show called on Netflix called Altered Carbon. Kind of gave me that Westworld feel when I watched like the first season of that, kind of different, kind of the same, you know, real people that don't ever really die because they can pass themselves on. They call bodies sleeves because it's not really, doesn't matter if you have a body or not, you can still live by passing on your brain essentially in something called a stack into a new body. So it doesn't matter how old you are, if you're rich enough, you can just keep doing that. But I think now my dad has kind of told me about the Band of Brothers, which, have any of you guys seen that?
HBO?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got on my to-do, but I haven't started it yet.
So a friend of mine from college was like, hey, I'm going to start this, and does anybody kind of want to jump in? I was intrigued. It's actually on Amazon, what is it, Plus?
Yeah, Prime.
Or Amazon's Prime. Video service, Amazon Prime service. So it's on there. You can go and watch it. I'm watching it because my dad told me, first of all, it's really good. And second of all, it kind of brought tears to his eyes because my grandfather actually was part of the medical unit that followed those guys into wherever they dropped into. So for me, it's kind of a history piece. Like, you know, he'll never be in that film or anybody that's even based on him or whatever. But you know, there's some really neat stories that I was told based on his time there. So it's neat to hear those guys talk. Okay, David, you're up.
So really two things. One, the wife and I are watching How to Get Away with Murder on Netflix. Very intriguing law show. probably wouldn't recommend that one for young viewers either. And then personally, I'm watching Man in the High Castle on Amazon Prime. Very intriguing show about in the World War II, where Japan and Germany are kind of running America and kind of what happens with that.
They won, right? In their version.
In their version. So very intriguing show. I'm only on season one, almost at the end of season one with that one. But both are they're entertaining.
John, what have you been watching lately?
Yeah, so life's been a little crazy, so not a whole lot of TV going on in my house at the moment, but obviously, there's Drive to Survive on Netflix, season two. It's a Formula One documentary. Very, very well made. I think they won some awards last year, but they're on season two. If you haven't seen it, definitely watch season one if you're just interested in racing as a whole. They really, like, dive into the drivers and really the action. Have some pretty amazing, like, action shots and stuff from the racing, which is pretty cool to see in 4K. Let's see. The wife is watching Suits. I think on Amazon Prime. It's an old show about a law firm, which has actually been pretty good from the episodes that I've seen. I think there's like 9 seasons, so plenty for you to binge watch for the next month. And then I'm going back and actually watching again for like the third time. going back and starting over with Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is the Larry David show. Gosh. Larry David, the producer of Seinfeld and many other great things. His own personal show that sort of is, I don't know, I don't want to spoil it, but it's pretty, pretty, pretty good. So
it's good.
If you watch the show, you'll know where that's from. But yeah, I would check that on HBO.
Fair enough. All right, guys. Any final thoughts for tonight? I thought we had a pretty good episode. You know, with COVID going on, there's not a lot of get out, get around, and, you know, have a good time. Hopefully with the warmer weather, you know, this will be able to get alleviated to where we're all able to be out and about and enjoy some good weather. You guys are already probably getting some up here where, as John already knows, we're still stuck in the trash. We're happy for 60 degrees if that hits.
You know, it's been another 3 months or 4 months before it actually gets truly warm. So
yeah, so it's been in the 80s the past few days, so I'm happy to go back down to the 60s. However, since there is no sports going on, props to the NCAA for allowing spring student athletes to get an additional season of eligibility. So
yes,
one of the few things the NCAA has done as a positive the past few years. So good on them.
Yeah, not much for me. I've been watching some sim racing, and NASCAR had theirs, which was kind of interesting. It was actually, to me, a little bit more interesting than actual NASCAR race. It was shorter, too. IndyCar did the same thing. I think they did a simulated Watkins Glen. I think actually Jimmy Johnson got in on that. Formula One's been doing the same thing, so it's actually been pretty entertaining to go on, you know, YouTube or Twitch or whatever and watch these races and see some of the amateurs go up against the pros and have beaten them in some cases. So yeah, it's been good to it's kind of the only sports that we can still have right now and with and still be competitive. So that's been pretty cool to see.
Absolutely. All right. Well, guys, I thought this was a great episode. I really enjoyed it. Hope you did too. For all of our listeners out there, you know, and again, any questions you guys have or topics you love us to discuss, maybe go back to some old episodes and drag up some questions that we really wish we didn't had said certain things. And now we'll have to pay for it by answering them. You know, by all means, get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you and respond to that. But in the meantime, let's definitely say good night to this one. And we'll see y'all next week.
Later.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you'd like to have your sports-related question or comment featured on the show, please email us at sportstalkgarage@gmail.com. Also, if you want to keep up to date with us outside of the show, please follow us on Twitter at sportsgaragepod. If you enjoy the show, please drop us a 5-star review and subscribe if you want to hear more. So for Chris back in the studio, David and Matt, I'm John. And we are the Sports Talk Garage.